The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
I've seen a lot of organizations that instead of starting with a future they want to solve for and solving for that future, they start with infinite list of problems they want to solve. And so what you can end up doing is you can end up solving problems that won't even matter a year from now.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Brian Evergreen. Brian's got some cool titles. So CEO and founder of the Future Solving Company, host of Future Solving, which is a podcast, also a top 30 thinker to watch, and author of Autonomous Transformation. So we're going to be diving into some really cool conversations around people, technologies, vision, what's becoming possible for teams in the future. Welcome to the show, Brian.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. So we've had a few chances to catch up briefly, but I was saying pre-show, I'd just love to hear, like, where did it all start? How did you come to be bringing this energy and kind of inspiration forward?
It started in a library at a chess club when I was 6 years old. There was this local chess meetup that my brother and I loved playing chess, and my dad said, I heard about a chess club at this library, and we started going, and somebody said something about a tournament. And so, and my first tournament ever, I won two trophies, which you shouldn't normally be allowed to do. But what happened was they had a novice section that normally people would place maybe in that and win a trophy in that. And then they had like the normal, you know, for each grade level, there was a, they would give trophies out. And I happened to place, you know, I won, I don't remember, I think it was second place maybe of the novice group. But then I also got a trophy from, so for me, I was hooked. It's like two trophies, one
winning
tournament. Like, you know, put these in my room. They're not participation trophies, right? So, and from there, I just, my brother and I both became really, really, really passionate about it. And we studied under chess, you know, under grandmasters. And that's where I first, I mean, the thread that has weaved through my whole life has been strategy. Like, I first heard the term strategy at a very young age, started hearing about and learning about the connection between having, envisioning something that you want, working backwards to create a strategy to achieve that, rapidly iterating, which in chess and especially in games like speed chess, right, where you are still doing, a lot of times people think of strategy and speed being at odds with each other, but I experienced firsthand with speed chess, like, you know, being able to do strategy and when you have a 5 minute timer for your whole game and being able to, in real time, adjust and adapt your strategy. And so, yeah. And then from there, I when I was 12, I had to decide whether I'd gotten to a level where I had to decide, I was rated for those who are fellow chess nerds. I was around 1800 as a 12-year-old. And so not Magnus Carlsen level, but still pretty strong. And I had to decide, do I want to do chess full time and quit school and be homeschooled? Or do I want to stay in school? Which I also was really passionate about basketball and loved spending time around other kids. I couldn't imagine not going to school, and I had a lot of great friendships. So I quit chess, stayed in school, started teaching private lessons. And I think that's been another big building block of what I do now, because I started teaching younger kids how to play chess. So I was teaching kindergartners when I was 12, and then that sort of kept, as I grew older, I taught older and older kids. And my first two students ever took first place in the nation for their age groups.
Wow.
And so, yeah, and then my brother and I decided we could build a company when I was 17. We realized, oh, we've kind of created like a curriculum, a little bit of a methodology about how to teach chess, when a lot of times at that time it was grandmasters teaching chess in this very esoteric way. And so we realized, oh, we could teach this. We figured out a way to teach this in a very simple, but still getting people to the point where 1 year through our program, they can play chess blindfolded. So it was simple, but practical. And so by the time I studied music theory and composition in school, like you do. I was just very passionate about that. And I felt like I was already learning business skills in the real world. So I decided I'm going to let school almost be a bit of a, like a relief from that. And so I was very, very passionate about classical music and post-minimalism for those who are in that world. And then when I graduated, we by the time I graduated, we were in about 200 schools. A couple years later, we were in over 400 schools in the Southern California area, including near where you live. And then I decided to go do something else. And I joined, I looked around and thought, what are all the different things I could do? And consulting looked like a really interesting industry. And so I'm going to skip past the whole story of how I got there, but I ended up joining Accenture and working in strategy with Microsoft as my first ever client. So that's where that was sort of slipstream me into technology and a passion in analytics. And then I was young and very hungry. And so I decided I'm going to learn how to, first it was SQL. Then it was, I'm going to learn dashboarding. And then it was, I'm going to learn JavaScript and I'm going to write my own apps. And then I'm going to lead AI projects. We were just calling them data science and ML projects back then, right? But like, and then eventually joining Microsoft, where I was a US AI strategy lead. I'm skipping over many years here, but, and then later moving into, and that was the, I think, a pinnacle moment for me of bringing, of all these threads coming together, where I was sent by Microsoft to meet with these Fortune 500 C-level exec teams and help them develop, because Microsoft's like, this is 2019. They were saying, hey, we've got all these great AI offerings. They're not really being adopted like we would have thought. And so there's some kind of knowledge or awareness or strategy gap. And so they hired me to basically go meet with them. And I was the USAI strategy lead. And they said, we want you to help them figure out what it is they're trying to do and develop a strategy for this. And so we would go out and we'd say, okay, what's your vision? What are you trying to achieve? Do you want to create a new growth market? And a lot of times they were saying, well, we don't even know where to start. And I realized, oh, there's this huge gap in the market. There's not enough resources for helping these leaders. They've gotten to where they are because of being great operators. And now suddenly they need to move from operations to being a great, you know, from taking commands and going and executing well to coming up with what you should do in the first place. And it's just a fundamentally different skill set. And then I looked around, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to look for the different playbooks that are out there. And there was a digital transformation playbook. And there was, you know, the sort of all these different things like Lean Six Sigma and a lot of incrementalism mindset types of playbooks. Because in digital transformation, you don't need to have a big vision to go from one version of an app that's creating value, modernizing it to make it cleaner and more efficient and create some more value. That's like an ideal incrementalism exercise, right?
Yes.
And so they don't have, you know, there wasn't a lot of resources out there. So I realized, okay, there's not a lot of resources for vision. And the process for strategy is too convoluted, you know, and people don't really understand systems thinking because they think of it all as very abstract, but it's so critical at this level of seniority. And then they don't know how to do story. Like most of the time they've seen storytelling as like an extracurricular thing. And to me, I honed in and I was like, if I can help people, if I can create a system of leadership that can support and augment, initially just driven by purely practical needs of like, I need to deliver these strategies with these companies that will help us succeed in the charter I've been given by Microsoft. Yeah. But then that later turned into, now I'm joining Microsoft Research to work on autonomous AI co-innovation, which means the level of complexity goes even higher, right? Yeah. And but still the same general charter, same general goals. And so I started writing and realizing, okay, there's no other system out there like what I'm creating. A lot like, and the way I was thinking about it was James Clear, you know, in Atomic Habits said, you don't rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. And I felt I'm creating a new system of leadership that's sort of built for purpose for the era of AI, driven by practical needs instead of research, backed by research, but starting with the impetus of practical application. And so, and then I started sharing about some of the things I was learning online, and Wiley reached out and said, would you like to write a book about that? And that's so silly to say no to. And so I did. And when I announced it was coming out, I'd worked with so many different senior leadership teams that this is back when LinkedIn was really nice to people and their posts were really wild, right? And so I had all these people say, hey, will you come speak? Will you come do a workshop with us? Will you? I sort of added it up and realized that's getting close to like where I'm at with Microsoft if I bill for all those engagements. So I decided to sort of take a leap of faith and go try to build my own business. And I founded the Future Solving Company then. And I thought, okay, I'll see it through the book launch. This was in January 2023. Thought I'll see it through the book launch of August 2023 and either go back to the corporate world with my tail between my legs or realize this is working and keep going. And now coming up
rocking it
later. Yeah, we're carrying on. So
that's awesome. And I love that from an early age, you clearly weren't afraid to fail and you clearly enjoyed the connection to the people and to the problems. I can see that theme from, you know, the chess to the teaching all the way through. So that's super cool. I love that story.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, to be honest, there's really very few things as rewarding as teaching kids, honestly. Yeah. I remember, especially when we started realizing we could have a lot of fun by hosting a kind of expo night of, hey, your kids have been learning chess with us. Let's come together, order some pizzas and show you what we've done. And I don't know how we came up with it, but we realized it could be kind of fun to have the kids that have learned to play chess blindfolded turn away from the board, teach their parents how to use the algebraic grid to describe, okay, I moved my pawn to e4, and have the child, and like 9 out of 10.
They're like puppeting their parents?
The child would be facing away. We'd even do blindfolds. And the parent would say, okay, I moved my pawn to e4. And the child would just be looking away and saying, okay, I'll move my pawn to e5. And then the parent would be like, okay. And the parent would move the piece for them, right? And they'd say, all right, now I'm going to move my knight to f3. And then they'd go, okay, I'll move my knight to c6, right? And they'd be playing. And 9 out of 10 times, they would beat their parents without ever looking at the board. And parents
That's
were
so
like,
cool.
We've been paying like $12 a week for this thing. And what in the world? And so, yeah, it was a lot of fun to very, very rewarding. And so it's been fun and interesting to see how that thread of a passion for teaching and for making like things simple and actionable has weaved through everything that I've done.
Yeah. And I love also that point on, you say actionable, but you also said earlier, you know, strategy and speed and rapid iteration can be helpful. Mm-hmm. So the practical grounding. There's a lot of talk out there right now in the digital transformation world that companies are just getting overwhelmed because there's 50 to 100 new projects launching at one time. How do you kind of separate, you know, rapid innovation behind vision and going into strategy from like just overloading the slate with projects?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And what I would say is that if you start by having a vision, or I usually say an organization all up should have like 1 to 3 futures that they're solving for at a given time, a vision, ambition, a goal. It should be bold and achievable, right? And when I say achievable, it should be extremely, like, it won't motivate people very much if it's something that's like, oh yeah, we're just going to grow by 10% in the next couple of years. Like, that's not going to motivate people. It has to be something that feels like landing your feet on the moon. Like, it has to feel, and even the way it's worded has to be tangible. So when JFK said, you know, by the end of this decade, we're going to land a man on the moon and then return him safely home, right? That was the vision statement, so to speak. If he had said, by the end of this decade, we will complete a successful moon mission and, you know, and return home or return safely, like that slight nuance of difference suddenly becomes less, I mean, probably we might have still achieved it, but it's so tangible when you say land up, you can almost feel the footprints hitting the moon. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's grounded.
So I think that's the first thing, is having a really, really strong vision that people, they can emotionally connect with what it would mean if we achieve that. And then I think the second thing is that once you have that vision that you want to solve for, asking what would have to be true and creating, working backwards and saying, well, this would have to be true. That would have to be true. This would have to be true. That would have to be true. And not doing, I think the problem that I've seen a lot of organizations have is that they start, instead of starting with a future they want to solve for and solving for that future, they start with infinite list of problems they want to solve. And so what you can end up doing is you can end up solving problems that won't even matter a year from now. You can, the number of problems to be solved at any given point is absolutely infinite. There's truly no end. And so, but what you can find is, okay, if, for instance, like if, let's say you're in the banking industry and you say, well, right now in the contact centers, people are frustrated because they don't like that, you know, this IVR system is prompting them to do this thing. So that's a problem. We need to solve that, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, there might be in parallel another problem, which is they really want to talk to a human on the first touch. And there might be another problem, which is they want to be able to get help even like round the clock, right? And so being able to think through if you look at all those problems, it's tough to, the complexity can scale so quickly where it's tough to know even where to start. Yeah. But if you instead start with what would the ideal, like what should working, interacting with our customers look like? How easily should they be able to reach us? And what would be the ideal? Let's think of some scenarios of when and how they would reach out for help. And what the perfect way for us to be able to address them would be. And then in terms of your question about like the number of iterations, it actually becomes, you can more cleanly focus investments toward it. It all simplifies when you do it this way. Right?
Yeah.
Because then you might say, well, instead of trying to fix this thing, that thing, you might say, okay, so I want them to be able to, I want to bifurcate them or quadfurcate, you know, trifurcate them or however many furcations to based off of what we know about them. Like, this is something interesting that a telco I worked with did, where they literally just realized when people are calling in, we know ahead of time whether or not they're late for their phone bill.
And so yes.
Just prompt them up front. Hey, are you calling to pay your late phone bill? Instead of welcome to, you know, I almost said.
And dragging them through the whole list.
And, you know, click this, click that. And then they saw a lot of drop offs, right? But it was like, hey, we see that you're late on your bill. Are you calling to pay? Yes. Yeah. Okay, great. We'll take you through that flow. And they saw, I don't remember the exact amount, but it was like a $40 million a week or some kind of insane dollar saving by starting with what should be instead of what should, because problem solving at the end of the day is an elimination exercise. You're getting rid of something you don't want when you solve a problem instead of getting what you do want. And so, so to your question around rapid iteration, I think that people confuse, just like we confuse commotion for productivity, they also sometimes confuse speed, and they think of these things as, you know, strategy and speed, vision and speed. As you'll find leaders, I've worked for them in the past, where they'll say, okay, and we'll get to that later, like that strategy stuff, like we'll figure that out, that's, let's take that offline, but right now we just need to do this, right?
Operational efficiency, bang,
yeah,
bang, bang.
And it's it's the famous quotation of, that's been attributed often to Abraham Lincoln, which is, if you gave me X number of hours, I don't remember the exact number, but like to cut down a tree.
Yeah.
I spend like for 75% of the time sharpening the axe. And I think that's the thing I think a lot of organizations struggle with, is that they imagine that it'll take so long to develop a vision and strategy, or they think we would have to hire, you know, some major consulting firm. It'd be a 6-month process. And like, so then they don't have the right system. And so they don't want to do it. But if you have the right system in place, then you can develop your vision and strategy and continue to update it in real time all the time based on the context constantly shifting. And then your investments will be much, much more focused. And you can quickly identify what's everything that we're doing that's not aligned to the vision that we have, the thing we're solving for right now. And all of those projects can be killed.
That's very cool. It's interesting. You made some really good points there that resonate with a former guest, Luke Williams, Australian guy out of NYU that wrote the book Disrupt. And he talked about how incrementalism can be dangerous if you really want to disrupt. And his analogy was, we've got all these ingredients in the kitchen. Let's not make more food. Let's come up with different recipes. And that totally ties into that statement that you just made of get what you want, not, you know, get rid of what you don't want. Because I think if you can be clear on that, it motivates the wider team. The team knows what we're trying to achieve, whether it's for the customer or to make it easier for our suppliers to work with us or whatever it is. We want this. Mm-hmm. It's way easier to work towards that than elimination.
Exactly. And I can give you a tangible example from the CIO organization. So speaking to making a vision tangible, but also the way that it eliminates everything else, which is most CIO organizations struggle against shadow IT, where their internal partners are being hit up by vendors that want to sell them some form of shadow IT. And so a vision that I think is compelling and worth solving for, that I've shared with many IT vendors, and then it ends up resulting in a, hey, actually, can you come help us do a workshop on that? But the vision being, our work as IT is so good that our internal business partners laugh shadow IT vendors out of the room.
Oh, so you
You can feel it. Like when you say that, you can all of a sudden you can imagine like that moment and how great that would feel, how motivating that is. And then you can think, well, gosh, that's not happening today. So what would have to be true for them to laugh those people out of the room? Well, okay, well, our quality would have to be as good or better. Our cost would have to be as good or better. Our speed, our customer service, which is something we normally don't think about a lot because they kind of have to work with us. But like in consulting, if I don't like this analyst, not I, but if a client doesn't like an analyst, they say, hey, can you pull them off the project? Analyst goes to the bench. They're incented to reinvent themselves and sharpen their skills so they can get placed again. Otherwise, they could either stay on the bench and not get paid depending on the size of the firm, or Yeah. And so the natural, so identifying, okay, we have these competitive forces of IT vendors that are, you know, services and products. So what would have to be true about us for us to be the de facto where they're just like, go talk to IT. We like what they're doing with us so much that if they think you can support them, great. Otherwise, like, don't waste my time. Like,
yeah, I love that.
You know, it crystallizes things. Instead, you could, if you were going the other way around, you could say, all right, what are all the things about IT right now that are painful that we could try to change? Well, we have a long form. Let's make a shorter form. And sure, like that could make incrementalism. Like it could make, it would make your stuff better, but it would
not. You're always chasing your tail, I would imagine.
Yeah, especially if you're saying, if you want to have a, like a bold and achievable goal of saying, we a year from now, I want everyone in the, our whole business to be so obsessed with what we're doing that they don't want to work with any shadow IT vendors. Well, what would have to be true if we gave ourselves 1 year? Well, we'd have to make a lot of changes real fast. Okay, what would those changes look like? And so, like, let's build a strategy for that. That's to me that, and it's amazing. I mean, we saw a glimpse of this in the COVID era, where Dyson, for example, and all these other companies completely retooled themselves. Things that would have taken years of process and red tape and bureaucracy just cleared the way. And so, like, let's bottle that now. Let's do that again. Let's do that as often as we need to do that to create value, keep momentum, like keep things interesting and exciting for our people.
Yeah, definitely. No, that makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. Where it takes me to next, and I do want to come back to the book, but before we do that, systems thinking, you talked about specifically, you know, leadership in the business being sort of practically grounded, but for listeners out there that have heard systems thinking or systems-based design or whatever it is, there's a lot of jargon out there. Like, what is systems thinking to you? Where did that originate from for you, and how do you apply it?
That's a great question. I thank you for asking. And you know, we don't get enough opportunities to talk about systems thinking. So, like everything inside of our world and our organizations is made up of systems that have a distinct purpose and have parts to them that also serve purposes that serve the overarching system. So like in a car, a transmission has a purpose. It's useless outside of the system. Like there's no other world or form shape. I mean, maybe if you need to like defend yourself in a scenario and there's a transmission there, maybe you could kind of
hit someone with it.
The most effective thing. Right? Any other context, like a transmission, is utterly useless. Even an engine, one of the most important, powerful, expensive parts of the car system is useless in any other context. So what got me really interested in systems thinking was that when I was researching for my book, I'd been exposed to it. I'd learned some things that I'd been required to learn at different points. But I kind of realized, oh, there's this whole movement of thinking and research and writing that's been done spanning back more than a few decades. Like the 50s, people were talking and writing about things that when I was at Microsoft in 2019 trying to help people figure out AI strategy was like, if we all knew and understood this thing that someone wrote about in, you know, 1952, we would have saved ourselves a lot of trouble. And I realized, okay, I'm going to go back to my definition of systems thinking in a second, you know, but I'm not dodging it. But basically it was, if we can go back, what I realized, what's missing? Why aren't they, why don't we all already know this? Why isn't this just baked into how we think? And I realized what I came to, I'd be curious if you agree or, you know, is the wording of it, the examples, it's sort of like a lot of philosophy, right? Where the way that it's written can be prohibitive to people. And most managers and leaders are used to, from various sources, used to getting the quick and dirty tips. Here's the top five things you can do to this. Here's the three steps to do that. And those are all directional. They're never going to be comprehensive. You're not, if you spend your whole life looking and listening to the three quick tips, you might incrementally become a slightly better leader, you know, over time.
Yeah.
But you're not going to have a leap, right? You're not going to become fundamentally better. You're not going to reinvent yourself or, you know, hockey stick with that kind of. And so that's, you know, that's, I think, why systems thinking is less popular. So the way that I think about systems thinking is understanding the dynamics between all of the systems. For example, the performance of the whole system of an organization, like a company, is not made up of the performance of each individual department, but the interaction between the departments is one example of being able to think about these system dynamics. So if marketing is like, full, this, we've seen this before, where everybody's green on the scorecard, but we're losing customers and we're not making more money than we
think. Yes. You
know, like we're still trending down as a company, but we're all green because it's not the sum of each individual. The best example I give is, or one of the examples I like to give is, if you had Beyonce sing in a choir, like she would need to grade her performance in order for the whole choir to sound good. And so what happens is a lot of times we get focused on managing individual parts of the system and optimizing them. We do this with AI. We do this in leadership. We do this with processes. We try to make this one little part better. And then we look, hey, this part's 15% more efficient. But if it's not, like, the measurement should actually be the interaction between the parts. So if you're in doing a marketing campaign, it doesn't matter your reach and your impressions and you know, your clicks, if it's not also converting, and that doesn't matter if it's not also like actually landing deals that are right for the business and for the
profitable customer. Scalable.
And then customer success is seeing that this is working out well. And you know what I mean? Like the whole system, just like a car, has to work smoothly together, but leaders generally aren't measured on that. And so that's one of the biggest gaps I've seen, is where they're really, really good at optimizing their one silo of the system. And no one really takes accountability unless you have a visionary leader for the whole system. And second, I'll just say one other part of my diatribe on systems is there's this something I wrote about in the book called The Lost Art of Synthesis. And most people, I don't know if you came across that one, but most people think about analysis. We're all very good at analysis. But at the same time that it was really, really deeply codified in the 1950s by the systems thinking movement, synthesis was as well. And we hear synthesis a lot. I think sometimes people, when they're making jokes about business people, right, they put synthesis on a slide and, you know. But it's rarely understood in this from the systems thinking context. The analogy I'll give is if you were to think about universities and ask, how well does this university perform?
Yes.
And how would you think about measuring that? I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I like to ask this rhetorically in keynotes, different things. And usually what comes to people's mind is, well, how many students are graduating from it? How many students are enrolling? How big of an endowment does it have? How many PhDs are graduating from it? How many PhDs work there? How many, right? Every single one of those metrics is a form of analysis, but not synthesis. And what it does is analysis, you take something that you want to understand, that thing being the university, which is a whole system, you break it into its individual parts. You try to understand each individual part and then bring it back into an understanding of the whole. And toddlers do this, right? They take something, they break it apart. Usually you can't put it back together, but they're trying to understand it. But it doesn't tell you why something exists or how well that thing is doing it, why it exists. It just tells you how it works. So if you came upon a newfangled device you'd never seen before and you broke it apart, you wouldn't understand what it was actually for. You would just understand more about how it works and what it's made of. And so in order to understand why and get understanding instead of just knowledge about it, you need synthesis. So synthesis instead takes the university and says, what bigger systems is this university a part of? Instead of it being the whole that's broken down, what bigger system is it a part of? And so it's a part of the academic system, the economic system, right?
These workforce other development, yeah.
Yeah, and then which is still part of the, I'd say, the economic. And then you'd say, in your case, what does workforce development, which is a part, you know, another way to describe the economic system, what does it need from universities? Oh, well, it needs students to graduate ready to create economic value as quickly as possible. Okay, well, that's different. Now I don't care how many PhDs are graduating. I don't care, you know, how many research papers are being written in that context. I'm looking very specifically at how many people are graduating and ready to immediately create economic value. So that's, and if you look instead at the academic system, what does it want from universities? Oh, well, it wants them to push the field forward. And then you do care about the number of research papers and all of that. So, So synthesis, we look at it as a part of the bigger system and then ask, what does that bigger system need from it? And then you disaggregate an understanding of the bigger system back down to an understanding of the thing you're trying to understand. And so that's just one example of so many times when I'm working with organizations and they're trying to do some, you know, blue sky, blue ocean, big picture thinking, is that they're missing some of these fundamental, I'd say, skills and techniques to do that and to think that way. And so that I've been sort of on a mission to help more and more people and take some of those things that are kind of behind this technically, academically written wall and figure out, how can I bring that over in the most practical, accessible way? I don't think I can boil it down to three quick tips in an art. But, you know, but that's been an important thing for me. And it's been really fun to see the difference that's made for the organizations I've been able to work with.
Yeah, I can already see it and I almost feel it, because I love the way you describe systems thinking. This synthesis concept I'd never really heard of in that way. And to me, it immediately links back to what you were sharing earlier about, you know, getting what you want and being part of the greater system of, like, hey, what role does our company play in the ecosystem? Exactly. So I think that's super cool. They're very tied to vision. Yeah, awesome. So let's jump to the book. So Autonomous Transformation, when I saw the title, I thought of Mortal Engines.
You are not alone. For me it was so simple. And it's funny, it's an example of, like, when you're so close to something, you see it differently than people who aren't. And so for me, it was, well, we've been going from analog to digital. The next mile marker is autonomous. Like that.
Yeah.
So analog to digital process is called digital transformation. Analog and digital to autonomous is now going to be called autonomous transformation. Nice. And at the time that I was writing it, there was alignment within Microsoft that there'd be this top level marketing push at the very similar timing of the book coming out. So I was like, I'm going to own the category. This is going to be fantastic. And then there was a reorg, like there always is. And then that didn't end up continuing. The book came out with its, you know, I'd left by then. But most people thought, oh, is this about cars? Is this about autonomous vehicles? Mm-hmm. And I realized, okay, I've made a mistake.
On something we need to understand better.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and more and more people, especially now that there's a lot of interest in AI agents, have been asking about, oh, wow, okay, this is interesting. You were like 2 years early on this topic. And so it's been great to be able to, you know, to build on and answer a lot of the questions people have now about stuff that I had already researched and written about.
And I wonder how it ties. Before the show, I was asking you, like, what's possible for teams in this future that you see? And I love the way you describe, like, hey, I think we're going to be able to harness, like, the JPL type Skunkworks energy and bring vision and alignment and systems to scale to individuals and small teams, so that what was once the ownership of a Northrop Grumman or a Lockheed Martin in their realm is now much more available to all businesses, all leaders, all teams.
I'm glad that resonated with you. I think we have a dearth of visionary leadership in society, in our organizations. Yeah. It's so rare. And the way I've been thinking about it, you can be one of my first people I test this way of describing it on, is saying Steve Jobs wasn't gifted. He had a different system.
Oh, I love that.
Okay, thanks. Good. All right. You really are.
Yeah, no, I love that.
That way. Because we talk about these luminaries as though, like, they were given some kind of, like, gift. There's some kind of oracle, you know, brushed up against them. And then they just magically were able to do these big, make these big swings, achieve these great things. But I, from what I've seen, the research I've done, the leaders I've worked with, it's actually a systems problem. And I don't mean that in terms of nerding out about systems thinking again, but just system with which you lead. Every single person already has a leadership system, whether they think about it like that or not. So that system has subparts, like the feedback system, the hiring system, the managing your
mental
team,
processing system,
all the stuff that just automatically runs for them, like autonomically, like the, you know, autonomic nervous system in our bodies, right?
Yeah.
It just, they automatically, that's how I give performance feedback. That's how I run a meeting. That's how I do this. And they often we don't think about it. Like, we naturally develop over time. Maybe we'll think about it if we read an interesting article or something, but we don't really like zoom out and just look at, this is my leadership system and this is how it functions for me and what it achieves. Unless you have a great manager or leader that's giving you a 360 feedback, maybe.
Yeah.
So I've been really excited about helping people, and I've been focused on, I realized there was a gap in the literature where harnessing and bottling and that energy, that visionary leadership where you're able to galvanize people, like giving them a picture in the first place of a future that's better than where we are today, that isn't just some kind of like shareholder growth sort of
narrative. Value creation plan.
Yeah. So having that picture and then developing a strategy that people can actually see and understand is a huge missing component that I've been at work, you know, and been helping organizations do. And then coming up and having an on a foundation of systems thinking so that you're not continuing to do sort of MacGyvering to try to get somewhere, but you're actually making huge fundamental changes to the system that are necessary. And then being able to use storytelling as a strategic lever to be able to spark change, help people make investments, help people come alongside what you're doing. Because, you know, Bill Gates launched a version of an iPhone, a smartphone, before Steve Jobs did.
Right.
But the storytelling about it, right? And the same thing with, like, General Magic launched a smartphone before like a decade before Steve Jobs did. But the system wasn't ready, right? There was a huge systems problem. So I've been really excited about and passionately focusing and working and researching and writing and helping organizations to figure out, okay, how do we actually build visionary leaders? How do we take our leaders now who are already amazing, and how do we like push them into that visionary leadership mode, give them the scaffolding and systems that they need so that they can step into that, own it, and then lead their organization toward an exciting future that people feel thrilled and passionate about moving toward.
Yeah.
It's been phenomenal.
It's energizing
and it's actually like repeatable, because when you actually look at it, like it is a different system. So you can quickly identify, you can assess and say, this is the leadership system I have now. This is what it produces. If I want it to look like that, these are the things that I would need to change. And then you can make the change.
Yeah. It's fascinating, because one of the emerging themes that's been coming up through this podcast lately, as we look at teams as a unit of measure, it's not the individual performances of people or individual systems like you talked to. We've kind of started developing some, let's just call it beliefs. It's not research-backed. We've started developing some beliefs that, you know, too much of the HR, monolithic HR systems are like here to fix people. But actually, to your point, everyone has their unique operating system. Mm-hmm. And rather than fixing them to do the quick tips on how to give feedback better, can we better understand what their innate operating system is? Mm-hmm. And then with your leadership system, say, hey, what parts can you kind of uplift and up-level here by communicating the way you process these things to these other team members and them doing the same back? So I'm starting to sense that there is a way to create shared leadership in teams. There is going to be a visionary leader, but can you almost unlock more of that, you know, following the vision, that alignment and that rapid iteration through a small team of people, because we're all much more aware of how we're wired. That's something that we're exploring, and a lot of your work sounds like it's adjacent to, perhaps even foundational, fundamental for that kind of movement to occur.
Yeah, it does sound like there's alignment there. And I would say that a great example of that is, you know, my alma mater, so to speak, of Microsoft, where, you know, it started with visionary leadership at the top, right? That changed from the traditional, like the entire mission statement of the company shifted, right? To being empower every person or organization on the planet to achieve more. That's something that, like, people deeply felt, I can say from experience, like people deeply felt that in their work. Like, I want to help people achieve more. Like, I, in my way, in my own role, I'm excited about that, right? And then to your point, everything else can fall into alignment behind that vision. And you can test anything and everything and say, is this thing that we're doing here, is that going to help people achieve more? And if it's not, we need to stop and we need to focus our energy and our investment on something that will.
Fascinating. No, this has been super cool. Super cool, Brian. There's been a lot of not quick tips, but great sound bites and kind of illuminations that have come from the conversation. Just to play back a few. I love the way from your early chess days, you were able to see that relationship between like strategy, vision, rapid iteration and the learning cycle. A lot of people are talking about how you can't set 3-year strategies anymore. You need to be coming together more regularly, making it a system. I love that fact, the dearth of visionary talent, the fact that so many of our leaders in industry have been great operators, but shifting to strategists in the current moment that we're in is a shift. It's no light lift. And then that kind of concept of, hey, we should have 1 to 3 futures that we're solving for that are bold and achievable with simple language. You know, that's accessible. You can bring all of the teams along on that. You can invite them to participate. So that's hugely energizing for me. And then you touched on, you know, not solving problems that won't matter, getting what you want. There's just a lot of really practical, grounded, accessible, you know, material there that I hope, you know, a lot of our listeners and I personally will continue to dive into. So thank you for coming on. And if any of our listeners want to find your podcast, Future Solving, or the book Autonomous Transformation, or you for some of the work that you're doing with the Future Solving Company, where is the best place to connect?
The best place is probably either LinkedIn. I'm LinkedIn /or .com/in, like I, you know, individual /Brian Evergreen, I think. So you can find me there. You can find me on, if you just search Future Solving anywhere that, you know, you listen to podcasts, you should be able to find that. And then, I also have a LinkedIn learning course that a lot of folks have been enjoying. It's a 48-minute kind of quick hit. And so they can find me on LinkedIn. On the futuresolvingcompany.com is been the convening grounds. We're putting more and more resources.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure we add some of that into the show notes, particularly the LinkedIn learning course.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sweet. Well, thanks, Brian. We'll talk again soon.
That sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.